We're delighted tonight to have our newest task force member, Dr. Ruth Loffert, who will be speaking to us this evening about, you know, comparing drug and device regulatory agencies in various parts of the world. And she has a great area, great expertise in that because of her experience in Australia in dealing with their regulatory agency. Ruth got her training in Australia with her bachelor's in mathematics at the Australian National University, and then her MD and a master's in public health and pharmacoepidemiology at the University of Newcastle. And she is a fellow of the Faculty of Public Health Medicine at the Royal Australian College of Physicians. How's that? And Ruth was from 2008 to 2011, was the chief medical officer in the Australian counterpart of the FDA, which is called Therapeutic Goods Administration. And in 2006 to 2007, she was a Commonwealth Fund Harkness Fellow in health policy as well. She actually established and directed the Pharmaceutical Policy Task Force in the Australian Department of Health and Aging and was responsible for developing public options to support the long-term sustainability of the country's pharmaceutical benefits program. So she's wonderfully experienced in Australia in particular and is now actually living in the U.S., and serving as the Deputy Director of Pharmaceutical Policy and Strategy at Management Sciences for Health, which is a nonprofit here in the D.C. area, and is also serves as an adjunct professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at GW University. So without further ado, let me go ahead and give you the floor, Ruth.
Thank you
so much on behalf of all of us for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Look, I'm just about to confess I was happily sharing my screen with the audience and the application suddenly abandoned and I've had to restart it. And now I'm actually having trouble sharing my screen again. Doesn't seem to want to do it now, which is really, really quite distressing. We test drove this and it worked perfectly and I had it all set up and ready to go and it suddenly hung. I'm going to try and it died and then, oh, hang on. Okay. Now I'm okay. I'm sorry.
No problem.
Let's see how we go. Can you see that?
Yes, we can.
Excellent. So I don't have very many slides because when I started looking at this topic, I thought, oh, yeah, that's a really good topic. And, you know, I should be able to get a lot of material into a 25-minute talk. And then I started looking and I realized how much there was to cover. So I'm only going to talk about a few things, very basic things, and rely on questions from the audience for more detailed discussion, if that's okay, because otherwise I would have been preparing slides till the cows came home. So anyway, I wanted to start with just, rather than, I started preparing slides that compared the different agencies, and it was really too difficult and too complex to do. So I thought I'd just give you an overview of the TGA and the EMA, and I'm concentrating on those two because, as I said, this topic is bigger than Ben-Hur. I thought I'd talk about TGA because I know about it, and I thought I'd talk about EMA because it's the sort of major other regulator in the world and sets a lot of standards, so I think that's appropriate from that point of view.
Can you translate the eponyms for us?
I'm sorry?
The TGA is what?
Sorry, the TGA is the Therapeutic Goods Administration, a wholly unexciting title for an agency which is actually a division of the Department of Health in Australia. And it was established in 1997. Before that, it was called the National Biological Standards Laboratory. It's always been a division of the Department of Health, but is separately funded, but I'll come to that in a moment. So the mission of the TGA is the protection of public health through the appropriate regulation of therapeutic products. And unlike the FDA, it has no requirement to promote innovation. Its role reflects the objectives of the Australian National Medicines Policy, where there are four main pillars, one of which is the ensuring that Australians have access to medicines of appropriate quality, safety and efficacy. It's a small agency, 700 staff more or less. That's excluding contractors. Now, if you think about that, that's about a 20th of the size of the FDA. And it also has roughly about a 50th of the budget, has an operating budget of about $150 million per annum. Now, $150 million per annum, I think, is about $110 million US dollars, because the Australian dollar is sort of the South Pacific peso at the moment. The remit of the TGA is prescription OTC, complementary medicines, vaccines, devices, blood tissues and emerging technologies. It has no responsibility for food, tobacco or veterinary products. The main legislation and regulations covering the activities of the agency are the Therapeutic Goods Act 1989 and Associated Therapeutic Goods Regulations. The key thing of interest here, I think, is that the operating budget is not only small, but the entire agency is run, is fully cost recovered from industry fees and charges. We've had a series of governments who have made cost recovery of various regulatory functions a mandatory requirement. So TGA has no operating budget from the federal budget or any other source of income, which of course raises all sorts of questions about regulatory capture, which I might talk a bit about later. I just want to stick with the facts and figures for a moment. So it is a tradition when talking about the Therapeutic Goods Administration that one shows a photo of the premises. And this is interesting only because the Therapeutic Goods Administration enjoys a location which is slightly out of town from Canberra, surrounded by fields, as you can see. And this was because when it was established, there was a fair degree of animal testing going on. What's interesting about it is that one can stare out of one's office window and see kangaroos, snakes, and the occasional possum. So it's a slightly different view from most people's offices, I think. Okay, so moving on. So the TGA evaluation processes are generally based on European Medicines Agency guidelines, and in turn these tend to focus, be closely aligned with ICH requirements. The European guidelines are sometimes adapted for local conditions, sometimes they are adopted as is, but there's a much closer alignment in the processes and the thinking in Australia to the European agency than there is to the US. That is not to say there's not a lot of interaction and collaboration with FDA, but the way of thinking is much more aligned to Europe. The timeline for the evaluation of a new chemical entity at TGA is 255 working days minus any stop clock requirements. And this is also interesting because if this is a statutory requirement, if the TGA does not produce a decision within 255 working days, it loses 25% of the fees. And given that it's fully cost recovered, it can't really afford to do that very often. So there is a real impediment to get decisions out the door. The other issue that's about interesting about the evaluation process, which isn't on the slide, and I apologise because I ran out of time to produce the slides, is that the decision-making is entirely made by a delegate within the TGA. The delegate is a delegate of the Secretary of the Department of Health. The Secretary of the Department of Health, unlike the US, is not a ministerial appointment. It's a permanent head of the department, similar to the English system. And the process goes something like this. The delegate of the Secretary is responsible for the overarching management of the application. It is farmed out to the various divisions within TGA for different components of the evaluation. And the delegate is responsible for assembling all the components and for any external evaluation that they contract. So there's a lot of clinical evaluation, Module 5 evaluation, that is actually externally contracted in TGA. When the delegate has assessed the application and got it to a particular point, it is then sent to the Advisory Committee on Prescription Medicines for advice. But all of the committees are advisory only. They have no decision-making role. And ultimately, the delegate is the person responsible for making the decision. If the decision is adverse or is not considered appropriate or reasonable by the applicant, then the applicant may make an application for an internal review. And the delegate who makes the review is a delegate of the Minister of Health in this case. So it's an internal review under the Act. And then if they're still dissatisfied with the outcome, they can seek a judicial review. So that's the process. The other thing that's probably of interest is that the TGA has no capacity or no provision for priority evaluation of anything. There's no priority review, there's no accelerated assessment, there are no shortened timelines. There can be informal priority to given to something which is considered a major breakthrough or for major public health reasons, but there's no formal requirement to do so, and it can't be formally requested. Those are the basic elements I wanted to cover. The other thing I wanted to mention, this was something that came up in the conversation I had with Lisa prior to this conversation. The TGA evaluates biological medicines as medicines. They're simply considered to be medicines. And while some of the evaluation guidelines that pertain to them will be different to small molecules, they're not considered separate. They're just medicines. And that has implications for intellectual property protection, which I will come to a little further on in the presentation. So just covering those points with respect to the EMA, the EMA's mission is to foster scientific excellence in the evaluation and supervision of medicines for the benefit of public and animal health.
Again, Ruth, you're fading out. Could you, your connection isn't too good.
Oh, sorry, I'm on the phone.
No, I realize. It's a little scratchy.
I'm sorry.
It's clear. If you can just increase the volume, that's the only thing. At least for me, it's pretty clear, but it's just the volume.
I'm sorry. I'll try and speak a little louder then. Okay, so great. The EMA, is that better?
Yes.
Turn the volume up a little on the phone. Okay, so the EMA's mission is to, the European Medicines Agency's mission is to foster scientific excellence in the evaluation and supervision of medicines for the benefit of public and animal health. So again, no obligation for fostering innovation. Its remit covers medicines and biologics and veterinary products, but no tobacco devices or food. The key statutes that govern what it does are the European Medicines Directives, the 82 and 83, which provide the legal framework for authorisation, manufacture and distribution of medicines in the EU. The agency is really small, around 600 staff, but it doesn't really do any evaluation per se. And its staff are augmented by 4,500 staff from the national drug regulatory agencies of the member states. It has a budget of around €325 million in 2016, of which about 85% come from fees and charges, 7% from an EU contribution to support, mainly for policies for orphan and ped medicines and so-called advanced therapies, and 8% from other sources which weren't specified. And they have an evaluation of up to 210 working days, not in counting clock stops. So please interrupt me if you have questions. The EMA's authorisation procedures reflect the makeup of the EU in that it has a centralised authorisation procedure for human and veterinary medicines that results in a single marketing authorisation that's valid in all EU countries as well as Iceland, Liechtenstein and Norway. Now, the use of the centralised procedure really covers most new chemical entities. It's compulsory for drugs for HIV, oncology, diabetes, neurodegenerative and autoimmune disorders and viral conditions, as well as biologics and orphan drugs, which doesn't leave a whole hell of a lot. It's optional for medicines that are significant scientific, therapeutic or technical innovations or whose authorization would be in the interests of public or animal health, but this is not closely defined. In addition, EU member states, each one has its own national authorization procedure for drugs that fall outside the scope of the procedure and is usually used for also for generic authorization. A decentralised procedure is also available, and this can be used for simultaneous authorisation of medicine in more than one EU country at once, as long as that drug hasn't already been authorised in any one country. But if it has been authorised in one country, the company can apply for mutual recognition through the mutual recognition procedure to have the authorisation recognised in other EU countries. Now, the way in which this works is when the application is submitted, it is assigned to one of the EU member states' drug regulatory agencies for primary evaluation, and the representative of that agency on the Committee for the of Human Medicinal Products, which is the decision-making committee of the EMA, the representative of that agency is the rapporteur for that evaluation on the committee. But unlike the TGA and the FDA, as far as I understand it, the CHMP actually makes the decision, and the decision's binding. The committee, of course, is made up of representatives from each of the national agencies, usually but not always the head of the agency concerned. So those are the key things. The next thing I wanted to do was to talk about a comparison of the data protection provisions. Because one of the things that's particularly of interest is, to me at least, is the differences between IP protection between the agencies. Now, all of the agencies, all of the countries concerned have similar patent provisions, with the exception of the US, which allows 6 months of patent term extension for paediatric trials. But other than that, everyone has 20 years of patent term with up to 5 years of patent term extension for delays in the marketing approval process. But the interesting differences arise from differences in data and market exclusivity. So for those who are not au fait with the FDA's provisions on data and market exclusivity, they go something like this. For a new clinical entity, the that minimum protection period is 5 years. For orphan drugs, it's 7 years. For paediatric trials or requested by the FDA, there's an additional 6 months plus an additional 6 months of patent term extension. New indications get an additional 3 years. Antibiotics under the GAIN Act get 10 years. Biologics get 12 years. And the first generic to come to market having submitted and Para 4 certification under the abbreviated new drug application provisions gets 180 days. Now, this compares with TGA, for which, as I said, we do not distinguish between biologic-based medicines and small molecules. So every product gets 5 years of data protection across the board. And it is data protection, not data exclusivity and not market exclusivity. Now, for those of you, and I apologise for those of you familiar with this, but the differences between data protection, data exclusivity and market exclusivity are subtle. Data protection regimes protect only undisclosed data. So if the data in the public domain, there's no protection. Data exclusivity provision protects data irrespective of whether it's in the public domain or protect or confidential. And a market exclusivity period is the period in time in which the regulator cannot actually approve an application. So, in fact, under FDA rules, the biologics, we hear about 12 years of exclusivity for biologics, 12 years of market exclusivity, but only 4 years of data exclusivity for biologics. For the TGA, the data protection regime, is the only protection for undisclosed data, You do not give additional exclusivity for... Sorry, my session's just terminated again. I'll just talk if that's okay. TGA does not give protection to new indications. There's no additional exclusivity. And the data protection provision protects only undisclosed data and doesn't, therefore does not preclude the submission of a literature-based submission. By that I mean if a generic manufacturer can assemble enough data from what is available in the public domain to substantiate an application, they can submit that application prior to the expiry of the data protection period because they won't be relying on the data submitted by the originator to support their application. Under the European Medicines Agency, there's a data exclusivity regime of 8+2+1. That is, there is 8 years of data exclusivity for any product approved after 2005, 10 years of market exclusivity, so that means the EMA can evaluate the product after 8 years but cannot approve it until 10 years, and there's an additional year for new indications. The other key difference between the agencies with respect to intellectual property protection is the FDA's Orange Book and the explicit requirement for patent linkage, by which I mean that when considering an application from a generic manufacturer, the generic manufacturer must make a certification under either Para 1, 2, 3 or 4. A Para 1 certification says there's no patents listed in the Orange Book. Para 2 is, I think, patents listed in the Orange Book have expired. Para 3 is patents listed in the Orange Book will have expired by the time the product is approved. And Para 4 is where the generic asserts that they're non-infringing or that the patent is invalid. So they're challenging the validity of the patent or the assertion that they're infringing it. And it's only those generics that submit a Para 4 certification successfully that are entitled to that first 180 days of exclusivity on the market. The TGA does not have an Orange Book, but it does have what I call an attenuated patent linkage provision in that a generic coming to market must certify that it will do so in a manner that does not infringe any patent on the product. But we don't provide a list of the patents that are relevant. They have to figure them out for themselves. And they only have to certify to us that they don't intend to infringe. They don't have to provide evidence that they're not infringing. The European Medicines Agency also has an Orange Book equivalent, and patent linkage is expressly not permitted under the European Medicines Directive, which states explicitly that a generic can only be approved on the basis of safety, efficacy or quality. So that precludes the assessment of patent status of the originator as a grounds for declining the approval of a follow-on product. So the other couple of things I wanted to talk about, and as I said, there are so many topics and so many areas of discussion that I had to pick and choose. I want to talk about two other things. One is about biosimilars and the other is about advertising and promotion. With respect to biosimilars, of course, the FDA has only approved one biosimilar product to date, and that was last year, and that was a filgrastim, Xarxio. But interestingly, there are a number of biologics for which follow-on products have been previously approved by the FDA, but not using the biosimilar pathway, and this includes heparins, growth hormone, and insulins. Part of the reason for this is historical. It's because, of course, the biosimilar pathway applies to products that were originally approved in the Public Health Services Act as opposed to the Food, Drug and Cosmetic Act. And the heparins, at least, were not approved under PHSA, but under DTCA. FDCA. Getting my acronym mixed up. I'm sorry? Was there a question or a statement or... I'm sorry, I can't hear. No? Okay.
No.
Sorry. So the TGA... has been approving, has been able to approve biosimilar products since 2010, and to date has managed to approve 9 products, a couple of brands of filgrastim, a couple of brands of filgrastim, erythropoietin alpha and lambda, insulin glargine, infliximab, and folitropin alpha. Interestingly, despite all predictions to the contrary, the biosimilar infliximab has been designated as interchangeable with the originator infliximab, which is causing extraordinary consternation in Australia. There are follow-on growth hormone products, but they weren't evaluated by the biosimilar pathway. With the European Medicines Agency, of course, they've had biosimilar products since 2006. There are 20 biosimilar products approved to date. Filgrastim, a couple of erythropoietins, folitropin alpha, insulin glargine, infliximab and etanercept, and some somatropins. And, of course, you know, the number of biosimilar products available in Europe obviously reflects the longer period of time in which the evaluation pathway has been available. Interestingly, though, as you all know, the FDA has had an approval pathway for biosimilars technically since 2010, and we still don't have guidelines on assessment of interchangeability. So the other item that I thought I would mention very briefly, I'm conscious of the time, was advertising and promotion. Here is obviously another area of substantial difference. Of course, in the US, direct-to-consumer advertising of labelled indications is obviously approved. And, of course, we're seeing a big push at the moment for FDA to permit promotion of off-label indications. And I think that's a whole other subject for discussion, but a very, very worrying one in my view. The TGA in Australia has no permitted direct-to-consumer advertising. In fact, there are only 2 countries within the OECD that permit direct-to-consumer advertising in medicines, and the other one is New Zealand. Australia has no direct-to-consumer advertising, and direct-to-provider advertising not only must reflect on-label indications, but it must reflect on-formulary indications. So you cannot promote a drug to a provider without specifying explicitly those indications for which the drug is subsidised on the national formulary. Don't just have to be on label, they have to be on formulary. With the EMA, of course, being given the structure of the agency, there's no direct-to-consumer advertising, but all other advertising is under the control of the relevant national drug regulatory agencies, so it varies from country to country. So I think I might just leave it there. There's so much more I could talk about, but it would require a great deal more time. I'd be happy at this point to take some questions if you have them, and to see if there are other issues you'd like me to comment on.
Cool. Ruth, could you explain that difference between on-label and on-formulary? Because I know since Australia has a national health system, does on-formulary mean that the national health system has decided to pay for it?
Yes. It doesn't just mean that the National Health, the Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme is the name of the drug program. It doesn't just mean that the program is paying for the drug, but when the program lists the drug on the formulary, it will list it for specific indications, which may only be a subset of the labelled indications. And it's only that subset that it can be promoted for.
So is that a decision that's made like NICE does in the UK, where they look at cost effectiveness and other things than whether it's just safe and effective?
Well, let me put it this way. NICE does it like Australia.
Okay, gotcha. So Australia came up with it first. Gotcha.
We were doing it about 10 years before they started. Yes, it's a 4-hurdle system. and it relies on assessments of comparative effectiveness and comparative cost effectiveness with a whole lot of other factors taken into consideration as well. The point being that a drug that may have several indications, labelled indications, but may only be on the reimbursement formulary for a subset of them. And there's plenty of examples. I mean, a good one is erythropoietins, which are not subsidised in oncology in Australia, only for renal disease, for example.
Great, thanks.
But the regulatory agency itself doesn't have any say in price or
none whatsoever. No.
They're only looking at the efficacy and the safety of the drugs.
Efficacy, safety, and quality. And the provision of information to providers and consumers. That's all they're allowed to do. And, of course, all the other related activities, including post-marketing surveillance and so forth. But everything else, there's an absolute Chinese wall between anything to do with price, reimbursement, value assessment. They're completely separate. Never the twain.
Because but you said quality. How are they assessing quality of the drug?
Well, it's part of the standard assessment under CTD. There's a whole lot of there's a whole list of requirements that have to be met in terms of consistent with pharmacopoeia standards, stability, sterility, all sorts of things. But I mean, these are pretty much standard across agencies. The agency does batch release testing for vaccines, which I don't know whether that's standard procedure or not. I imagine it is, but it actually does samples and does batch release testing of all vaccine products.
Another question I have is on the way you say the agencies are supported by fees from the pharmaceutical industry and device industry, I presume. And is that something that companies all pay annually, that's a percentage of their profits, or is that something they pay every time they want to have a drug evaluated?
There's two forms. There's what we call fees and there's what we call charges. There are fees for evaluation products, so if you want to put a product on the Australian Register of Therapeutic Goods, you pay an evaluation fee, and the only time that fee is waived is if you're designated as an orphan. And that's what you get for being designated as an orphan. You get a waiver of fees.
Okay.
We have prescription medicines, non-prescription medicines, complementary medicines, devices and IVDs. And, of course, various biologic products. And anything that requires evaluation has a fee associated with it. And, of course, it's highest for prescription medicines because they require the most work to evaluate. Now, in addition, to maintain an entry in the register, you pay an annual charge. And that will depend on the nature of the product because it's a risk-based regulatory framework. The higher the risk, the higher the fee. And the higher the fee for evaluation, similarly. So that's what we mean by, that's what the difference is between fees and charges.
So is the price of a drug solely dependent on what the manufacturer wants, dictates?
Price of a drug is completely free to be set by the manufacturer. However, because there is a single national drug program and the government is an effective monopsony, 80% of the prescription drug market is reimbursed by the government and about 94% of the outpatient market.
Mm-hmm.
There is only a very small private market. So although drug prices are not controlled outside the drug formulary, the prices tend to track pretty closely to the prices for the on-formulary drugs. And the on-formulary drugs, the prices of these are indirectly moderated by the consideration of, by the formulary listing process, which utilises an assessment of comparative effectiveness and comparative cost effectiveness. The legislation that underpins the operation of the formulary committee says that it may not recommend for listing a drug that is more expensive than an alternative unless for some patients at least it provides an increment in clinical benefit. So they can't list a drug on the formulary that's more expensive than an alternative unless it's significantly better.
So that when drugs like the hepatitis C drug or Avastin first came out, where there are no comparable drugs, basically the manufacturer could say this is my price and the Australian government would be paying? Or do they...
No, absolutely not. With the Hep C drugs, the view was that there were alternatives. They were just more toxic and less successful. So it would be... The nature of the evaluation is that the drug proposed for listing on the formulary is compared with the drug most likely to be replaced in practice. And there are already treatments for hepatitis C. So it would be based on an assessment of comparative benefit and comparative cost vis-a-vis the therapies already listed on the formulary, which would be ribavirin and pegylated interferon. And the committee would look at the difference in benefit, because clearly the DAAs are much more effective, and it would look at the difference in cost, and it would look at the incremental cost-utility ratio, and it would make a determination whether that was acceptable or not. Now, I don't have the details, because obviously they're confidential. The Australian government has listed direct-acting antivirals on the formulary for every patient without restriction. So they must have got a hell of a discount, is all I can say. I don't know what it is.
And who does the bargaining for that?
The departmental offices.
Departmental offices of health,
yeah,
or something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, if the the formulary committee says the drug isn't cost-effective, then that's the end of the line.
Right.
The company has to come back and make a resubmission or drop the price or find better evidence or narrow the population in whom they're proposing it for the formulary. But
is there any affordability issues at all then? I mean, with the system, it sounds, you know, fantastic, you know, the fact that they're taking comparative effectiveness in terms when considering price. But are there issues of affordability for subpopulations?
Absolutely.
And how is that addressed?
Absolutely. It's part of the PBA's, the formulary committee's remit to consider total cost as well, both to the drug program and the healthcare system. They're required to consider that as well in their determination. And that's really interesting because they were taken to court about 15 years ago by Pfizer for considering total cost. Pfizer said that wasn't in their remit and they had no right to consider it. This was when they rejected Viagra. And the federal court found that not only was the committee right in considering total cost, it was required to. So since then it's been very, very explicit. They do consider total cost. And the government has been trying very hard to make sure major new listings on the formulary are offset by savings in other areas. So yes,
can you tell me a little bit more about this committee that's making these determinations of the affordability versus benefit? Who are these people? Are they elected? Are they chosen? Or are they medically professionals? I mean, who's making those decisions?
Okay, well, the committee has 18 members, most of whom are medicos, but not entirely. It has medical specialists for a number of different specialties, including primary care. It has a representative of retail pharmacy. It has a couple of consumer representatives, and it has a health department. Some of the committee members are appointed by the minister and some are nominated by various societies, NGOs. The idea is that the committee is not going to have representatives of every medical subspecialty on it, but is able to draw on additional expertise if it needs it. But it has a good spread of expertise. And the important thing is that the members are able to evaluate evidence. The committee terms are about 4 years, because it takes a good 2 years to come up to speed in this. It's an advisory committee only. The committee makes recommendations, but the minister has the final decision. However, the legislation states that if the committee says no, the minister cannot say yes. And if the committee says yes, the minister can make a decision based on whether or not there's sufficient budget to cover it or whatever other reasons the minister sees fit. But as I said, it protects the committee and the process from political interference, because no matter how much people lobby the minister or how much pressure is put on the political process, the government can't put a drug on the formulary.
They can't put a drug on the formulary, they what?
Unless the committee has recommended it, the minister can't decide to put a drug on the formulary herself. She can only do that if she's received a positive recommendation from the committee. So it's like a NICE recommendation. NHS can't fund a therapy unless NICE has recommended it. Is that helpful with respect to the committee? And there's a great deal more I could tell you about it, but I'm conscious of the time.
No, thank you so much. I think this has been very interesting, and we'll continue to pick your brain separate from this call, of course. And also, you know, Ruth has kindly agreed to talk next time also about how different countries deal with device approvals, and also look at the TPP for us, because she's done some specific work on that and how that will affect all these agencies. So thank you very, very much.
And pleasure.
Yes,
sorry
and
about
now,
the problem.
And now we should go going on.